started to say that I profoundly miss my friend Rabbi Yosef Glickman all the time over these past 2 years since he was so suddenly taken from us. And I know that I'm not alone. I know that there are so many who feel that way, so many families, so many friends, so many students, so many colleagues, so many of those who were privileged to know him in any of the many venues and walks of life that he traveled. And all of us miss him constantly, but particularly in this time of great challenge, in this time where we need wisdom, where we need balance, where we need insight, where we need guidance. I know that so many have commented, if only Reb Ozer was here now, if only Rabbi Glickman was present to give me counsel, to give me support, to give me insight, to give me perspective, how much his voice is missed. So we miss him all the time. We miss him now particularly, and I miss him now for additional reasons. I miss him before Pesach. He would come to my house occasionally right before Pesach and ask if he could sell his chametz. And that's one of many reasons why I selected that topic to talk about tonight and to devote to his memory. And we will find that there are additional reasons. But together with that, one of the major themes in the concept of selling chametz is the idea of making a kinyan, and all of the complexities of how one makes a financial transaction come alive in actual practicality in the process of selling chametz. And the notion of kinyan was of particular fascination to Reb Ozer. It was a topic that he talked about a lot, and it was a topic that he devoted multiple sessions of his business halacha to. He was very, very taken by the whole notion of the various methods that halacha has for transferring ownership, for signifying that process of acquisition. And there's nothing that we do today that puts more attention and that gives more opportunity to study the topic of kinyan. And that is one more reason why I wanted to talk about that topic tonight, but also to try to get a little bit of perspective in a way that I think Reb Ozer would have appreciated particularly on the bad rap that Mechiras Chametz gets. Mechiras Chametz is often perceived as somewhat of a trick, somewhat of a joke, something that people don't necessarily take seriously, and something that engenders some degree of cynicism. There is a joke that is sometimes told, and I know Reb Ozer would have appreciated this as well, to say that the Orthodox rabbis, the rabbinical organization, prohibited smoking, but the Jews, they aren't concerned, they'll simply sell their lungs to a non-Jew. And it represents that perception that sometimes emerges that we can take care of any halachic problem simply by selling whatever it is out of our hands into the hands of a non-Jew, and that's some kind of a magic incantation that somehow takes away any kind of halachic concerns. There's nothing left to worry about. And of course, we know that's not true. But it prompts the question, so how come sometimes it seems to be true and other times it doesn't? So how is it that when it comes to Mechiras Chametz, it seems to work for us that we can sell our chametz into the hands of a non-Jew, and that will somehow remove for us the issues connected to the prohibition of owning chametz on Pesach? And the truth is, it was a topic of big debate, and there were many great halachic authorities who weren't that comfortable with it, and there were some who had a begrudging relation to it. We'll try to discuss as much as we can in the short time that we have. And nonetheless, it's a process which seems to have gained pretty wide acceptance among the Jewish people, even though there are some hesitations and there are some modifications, as we'll try to point out. So how exactly did that happen? How is it that this apparent shtick, so to speak, to sell our chametz out of our possession, even though it remains in our houses, even though we know that inevitably after Pesach is over, we end up with the chametz again, even though we know that this is what happens every year, and that we never find the purchaser coming to our house over the course of Pesach and trying to take the chametz, and all of this makes us feel like it isn't really sincere. So how does that happen? How did that come to be something that we have found some level of peace with? That's what I would like to address over the past few minutes. So just to try to first start with Talmudic sources. So we do find the concept of selling an item into the possession of a non-Jew and addressing a halachic problem that way. We do find that in the Talmud. For example, we find it in the very beginning of Maseches Bechoros, where the Talmud talks about if one were to have an animal that's about to give birth to a firstborn animal, and that would prompt issues of Kedushas Bechor, it would have the sanctity of a firstborn animal, and there isn't really anything we could do about that today. So the Talmud indeed recommends selling some portion of it, going into some part ownership together with a non-Jew. So on the one hand, here you have this advised by the Talmud. However, we know it's different because there we're really stuck. There's no way to make that work. There is nothing we can do with it. It's going to be subject to sanctity that in the current era, there's nothing that we can actually make use of. There's nothing that we can actually put into effect, and it will be prohibited for other uses. So therefore, we have no choice but to try to avoid the situation by finding some other approach. So that is somewhat of a beginning of a discussion, but it doesn't really apply to the current situation where one simply could get rid of his chametz and doesn't necessarily have the same quandary that they would have in a situation where they have an animal that's about to give birth to a bechor. So in addition to that, the Mishnah does discuss in Maseches Psachim that one possible route of getting rid of chametz is to sell it to a non-Jew. However, there the discussion is actually selling it in a way that one never plans on seeing it again, and getting rid of it by divesting oneself of ownership permanently. So if that's what we're talking about, you're going to sell it and say goodbye to it. Okay, so that we would understand, but that also doesn't seem to cover what we have nowadays, where we end up getting the chametz back over the course of Pesach, and the chametz doesn't actually leave our house over Pesach. So how exactly is that going to be enough of a source? So there again, we're somewhat lacking. But there is a source that's a little bit closer, but maybe not close enough, or maybe yes, maybe no, and that is the Tosefta. The Tosefta, Maseches Psachim, discusses a situation where you have a Jew who's on a boat, and he's traveling together with a non-Jewish associate, and he realizes that Pesach is apparently on its way, and he still has chametz in his possession. So what should he do? How should he handle the situation? So there the Tosafta describes that he could take the chametz that he has, and he could gift it or sell it to this non-Jew. And then after Pesach, he would arrange to reacquire it from his possession. So that is closest to what we have today, but it's still not fully there, because there the connotation is that this is a one-time kind of thing that happened in a less than ideal situation. You found yourself on the boat with a chametz. You didn't realize that you would be stuck with it. And now you have to have a solution to the problem. So what do? So you have to come up with some kind of a non-ideal kind of resolution. But to say that you should do this l'chadchila, to say you should plan this out, that we should have on our calendars that, okay, here's where we meet with a rabbi every year to sell the chametz, and to say that this is something that should be a regular practice that's going to be part of the plan and it's going to be accepted again and again, year after year, so that's not necessarily the connotation of this description. So how did it morph from one to the other? So here there is some significant debate, and it's also noteworthy that a number of the Rishonim who quote this Tosafta, and indeed this is quoted by many Rishonim and quoted in the Shulchan Aruch as well, but many of those who quote it, they have that key phrase, which is one of our great concerns here, and that phrase is harama. Harama is the phrase which could be translated neutrally, it could be translated more pejoratively. It often is translated as a evasion, as a way of getting out of things, a way of escaping one's obligations. So that certainly has a very negative connotation. Sometimes in some contexts, it's a little bit more neutral, such as when we have no choice, but we have to avoid a problem, so we have to go around it. But very often it has that negative connotation, and it's something that we're uncomfortable with. It's something that makes us feel like we are perhaps satisfying the letter of the law, but missing the spirit of the law completely. And that's a part of what worries us when it comes to Mechiras Chametz. So here we find that a number of the Rishonim have the phrase that you can do this, you can avail yourself of this plan, ubilvad shelo ya'arim, and as long as it's not a haram, as long as it's not some kind of evasion. So that's a problem that scares us a little bit. So we have to figure out what exactly that means. What exactly are we being told here that we cannot do? So there are different interpretations in the Rishonim. Some of the interpretations are more problematic for us. Some of them are not so problematic, and some we have to figure out a little bit. So for example, some of the Rishonim, such as the Ritva and others, they understand this to mean ubilvad shelo ya'arim, as long as you don't do this every year, as long as it's not a regular thing. So if that's the interpretation, so that does worry us. That's not something that's going to fit so well with our current practice. But luckily, there are other interpretations as well. So there are some who interpret in a way that's really not a problem for us necessarily. The way the Rambam expresses it, and the way a number of others express it also, the Shulchan Sadesha and others, that what we're talking about here is that it cannot be a matana almanas lahachzir, which means it cannot be done as a gift that is explicitly conditioned on the purchaser, on the receiver, giving it back afterwards, that's the condition of the acquisition, that he's taking this with an understanding that he's obligated to give it back afterwards. We call a matana almanas lahachzir. So that's, some of the sources said, so that's too much, that we can't allow. Now, it's an interesting parenthetical question. Why should that be a problem? Because the truth is, the Talmud discusses this concept of matana almanas lahachzir, of a conditional gift that one has to return afterwards. And the conclusion of the Talmud is that that is a valid gift, that during the time that it's in the possession of the recipient until he has to return it, during that time that he has it, it is halachically his. So if that's the case, so then maybe we should say that even a matana almanas lahachzir works. So this is a question the later authorities tried to figure out why it should be a problem. Some understood maybe it's just a stringency of chametz, that when it comes to chametz, we're a little bit more careful about it than what would work in other things and other contexts is not going to work here. And there are others who suggest that maybe, again, it's just a question of this being too much, that to have it explicitly conditioned on it coming back afterwards, that's more than we ever see nowadays. We have a situation nowadays where among the various transactions that the purchaser makes, so he also undertakes a commitment to pay for the value of the chametz, and he has until after Pesach to make good on that payment. And if that payment is not something he's willing to do after Pesach, so then we make an arrangement that we will let him off of that payment by taking back the chametz, which is a new transaction. It's crucial to understand it's not a reversal of the original transaction, because that would negate the entire process retroactively. But he has the option after Pesach to either pay for the chametz or to transfer it back. So that, yes, that does happen regularly, but it's not conditioned on that eventuality. We don't make the deal that he has to give it back, and therefore it doesn't violate this concern of the Rambam and some of the other Rishonim. There's another interpretation which may or may not be a problem for us. Turns out that it's not as much of a problem as it sounds like. Some understand that vulvad shelo yarim, it shouldn't be an evasion, that the idea is that the chametz has to actually leave your house. So that seems like it's a problem for us, because it doesn't seem like our chametz necessarily leaves our house. We keep it in storage in the basement or elsewhere. But if we look at the commentaries on the side of the page of the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch, the Bach and the Taz, they explain that the concern was simply that the purchaser has to actually acquire it, as Rabbi Glickman taught about in his classes about the methods of acquisition, that there has to actually be a process by which the purchaser does take ownership of the chametz, which isn't necessarily about him removing it from the house, but it's about him either lifting it up or doing one of the many other techniques that we have. And if anyone has ever witnessed the process of selling the chametz to the non-Jewish purchaser, you would see that we use about 6 or 7 of the kinyanim that Rabbi Glickman so lovingly taught about in his class. So we make sure that there is a process of transition from the Jew to the non-Jew, and therefore most of the commentary is understood that that satisfies this concern, and that there actually is a genuine transaction. But nonetheless, this concern that there's some kind of a harama, that there's some kind of evasion, that there's something that's not 100%, that has dogged Mechiras Chametz, that has continued to be an issue of concern, an issue of suspicion, that the topic has been greatly controversial. And there were those who maintained that Mechiras Chametz should only work if we're dealing with Chametz that's prohibited midrabanan, if we're dealing with rabbinically prohibited chametz, and not if we're dealing with actual chametz that ownership is prohibited min ha-Torah, because if that were the case, how could we be satisfied with something that seems to be an evasion, something that does not seem to conform with the spirit of the law? How could that be okay? It must be that we're not, and we're only satisfied if we're dealing with rabbinically prohibited chametz. So therefore, there are many to this day who don't sell actual bread, who will only sell mixtures of chametz or other types of rabbinically prohibited chametz, but not actual chametz that is prohibited min ha-Torah in the full sense, because they are concerned that there is this haram involved, and it feels wrong, it feels like something that they're uncomfortable with. On the other hand, there was one of the commentaries, the Bechor Shor, who wrote that we can sell any chametz, but only because the ownership of even any chametz is only going to be prohibited on a rabbinic level. So what does he mean by that? The prohibition of owning chametz is explicit in the Torah. What does he mean that there's only a rabbinic prohibition involved? So the Bechor Shor said that the Talmud tells us that on a Torah level, the concept of bittul chametz, of declaring that you are not connected to your chametz anymore, that you are divorcing it, that's enough. That's sufficient in order to address the Torah prohibition. So therefore, we're only left with a rabbinic prohibition, and that's why selling the chametz works. So this was a controversial suggestion, because as many others pointed out, that the chametz that we negate with bittul and the chametz that we sell is not the same chametz. We sell chametz that we intend to reacquire after Pesach, and the chametz that we negate is the chametz that we don't know about, the crumbs that we missed, the little drops of chametz that we don't plan on ever seeing again. It's only in that context that we are mevatel the chametz, and it's there that the Talmud says that's sufficient on a Torah level, and on a rabbinic level require one to look around a little bit more, and that's why we have the institution of bedikas chametz, of searching for chametz. But the chametz that you plan on reacquiring, so that's not part of the bittul, and therefore, if we're satisfied with that, so then we have to be satisfied with this process as that which is effective even for Torah law. Even when dealing with the Torah prohibition of chametz, we are apparently, at least some of us, are apparently satisfied that it's effective on a Torah level. So how exactly does that happen? How exactly is that something that we have come to be okay with, and we're not concerned apparently about the problem of haram? And it's interesting just to quickly note that there's an even more controversial process than mechiras chametz, and that's what's known as the heter mechira, the idea that the land of Israel can be sold, or parts of the land of Israel can be sold into Arab lands for the duration of the Shemitah year, and that work can continue to take place on that land, is highly controversial. That's a perpetual motion machine for Machlokas, because every 7 years there's a whole new degree of dispute that surrounds that. The many who feel it's all the more necessary, many who feel it's all the more unjustified. Every 7 years there's another level of dispute. But it's important to note that as much as they sound very similar, we sell the chametz so to deal with the prohibition of owning chametz, and we sell the land of Israel or land in Israel to avoid the prohibition of Shemitah, there are some key differences, which is not to criticize one or the other. There's a great scholarship behind the Hetem Mechira in the land of Israel, but it's just noteworthy that there are a number of crucial differences. For example, when it comes to Shemitah, there's a specific Torah prohibition involved in selling the land out of Jewish hands. That was a big part of the objection, which is not relevant to chametz. In addition, so the selling of chametz seems to be more genuine, because if after Pesach, if the purchaser were to say that he's interested in keeping the chametz, so then we would say, okay, so then write us out a check for the full value and we'll be happy to let you keep the chametz. In the case of the land of Israel, if the Arab purchaser were to say after the Shemitah year that we're interested in writing out a check for $1 trillion and keeping whatever it is, however much of the land. So hopefully we would not be okay with that. And also, during the course of the Shemitah year, the land continues to be worked. During the course of Pesach, we don't have anything to do with our chametz. It's locked away, and we are sincerely disconnected from it. So there are a number of the three differences right there between the selling of chametz and the selling of the Shemitah land. And very crucially, a fourth difference, which I will come back to in a moment. But there are also two other differences that go in the other direction that seem to give a little bit more validity to the selling of land for Shemitah over Chametz. One is the assumption that Shemitah nowadays is a rabbinical obligation. That's how many assume, and the Het HaMechira is contingent on that understanding. While, as we said before, the ownership of Chametz and Pesach, as far as we know, seems to be a Torah prohibition. We should seemingly be more concerned about using such a technique in that context. The other question is the question of just how necessary it is. So if there's a real great economic need that the land of Israel is going to be challenged in a fundamental way by the observance of Shemitah, so then that's what drove many to say that we have to allow the Het HaMechira. For the average individual, the idea of losing the Chametz this year has some unique complexities to it, but at least in the average year, the concern of throwing away some of the chametz as opposed to selling it isn't on the same economic need level as the issue of Shemitah in the land of Israel. So there are a number of differences, and these differences are important to appreciate because every issue within halacha has its own nuances and has its own movements to it, and that's again a point that Reb Ozer was always sensitive to, and I think is part of the crucial issue here. So just to try to very quickly understand, so why is it that we've come to make peace to the extent that we have, that so many of us have, we've come to make peace with the idea of selling chametz? So I think perhaps it can be explained based on a position of the Ran. The Ran, one of the great Rishonim, in his commentary to Maseches Pesachim, in the very beginning of Pesachim, has a statement which probably many of the other Rishonim also agreed with. And there the Ran explains that the idea of selling chametz, the idea of not owning chametz on Pesach, that's what we used to explain, the idea of not owning chametz on Pesach, the Torah prohibition of Bal Yirah, Bal Yimatzeh, the Ran explains that the reason we have this prohibition is because really the Torah doesn't want us to eat chametz on Pesach. But it's a particularly dangerous prohibition because more than other prohibited foods, we're used to eating it. 51 weeks a year it's permitted, and it's a severe prohibition, has a punishment of kares, so therefore it's more severe and more tricky than many of the other prohibited foods. So here, uniquely, the Torah has to say, not only shouldn't we eat it, but we shouldn't even own chametz on Pesach. We have to get rid of it. We have to divest ourselves of the chametz on Pesach. So perhaps our understanding is that if the real goal here is that we shouldn't come to eat chametz on Pesach, so essentially what we're saying is that there are two ways that we can keep ourselves from eating chametz on Pesach. So one way is simply not to have any. If we don't own any and we don't have access to any, there's no chametz in our house, so then that will help keep us away from consuming chametz on Pesach. But there's another way also, and that is that if we create a prohibition of theft, of lo sigzol, of stealing, connected to the chametz on Pesach, that will also hopefully keep us away from eating the chametz on Pesach, because we are so committed to honesty in all of our dealings and to the integrity of our property and our ownership that our sensitivity to these values will keep us from eating chametz that does not belong to us. So therefore, what we try to accomplish through the kinyan on Pesach, before Pesach, through the kinyan to the purchaser, all we are trying to accomplish is make sure that there is technical ownership by the non-Jew of the chametz. Because once there is that technical ownership, so that creates a prohibition of taking it. We're not allowed to use chametz that doesn't belong to us. And that will hopefully keep us away from eating chametz as well. So essentially, the statement that we are making through this process of mechiras chametz is just how much we value honesty in business and just how important important it is to us that these transactions be handled with integrity. So once we have a prohibition, and that's all that matters, it doesn't matter if the chametz is technically on our property, it doesn't matter if after Pesach there may be a reversal of that, it doesn't matter whether or not the owner of the chametz actually takes it over the course of Pesach. The fact is that it's his property, and we have such respect for that reality that we are not going to avail ourselves of any of this chametz over the course of Pesach. So there's a very strong statement that we are making about our commitment to honesty and integrity through this process of selling chametz. And perhaps this practice became so widespread, recognition of an idea that the Smak comments upon in his sefer. The Smak comments that there can't be a geula, that there's not going to be a redemption of the Jewish people unless the Jews are perceived as people who are honest and to have integrity, because otherwise it will be a chil Hashem, it will be a disgrace to God's name, that the nations of the world will say, why is God redeeming this nation that is dishonest, that doesn't act with integrity? So if we want this month of Geula, this month of redemption, where we look towards both past and future redemptions, if we are going to hope for that to happen, so we have to make sure that we are perceived as people who are honest and have integrity. So perhaps, therefore, the practice developed that we should engage very publicly in a transaction with even a non-Jewish purchaser to show how carefully we take all of our transactions, and the level of commitment that we have to the integrity of that transaction, that is so absolute, that is as effective to keep us away from eating chametz as if the chametz wasn't even there in the first place. So there's an important mutual relationship here, that our act of selling the chametz and of our commitment to that is an emphasis and a strong focus on our commitment to honesty, and only works if we actually have that commitment to honesty and integrity. And if we are indeed carrying out that kind of attitude through the rest of our lives and the rest of our actions. And one of my students once asked that maybe we should say that somebody who cheats in business shouldn't be allowed to sell his chametz. And the truth is, perhaps that is indeed the case, that if one doesn't have a commitment to the integrity of ownership, so then the whole value of mechiras chametz is actually going to collapse. And I think that this is something also that Reb Ozer would have tremendously appreciated, as everyone who ever talked to him about anything, and certainly anything in the context of business and our responsibility towards the world, knows Reb Ozer was somebody who passionately believed in honesty and integrity and the role of the Jew in conveying that message and living that life in everything that he does. And when he came to me on Erev Pesach and sold his chametz, and we talked about kinyan and we talked about transaction, and we talked throughout the year about so many other values, I know that this is something that is so dear to his heart, and that it would be very meaningful to him to think of the process of mechiras chametz that way. And we are in a situation this year where perhaps many more will rely on mechiras chametz than they ordinarily do, and more attention and creativity will have to be devoted to how exactly to carry out the various kinyanim, the various transactions under these circumstances. But it's also a time when we are even more focused on our need for redemption, our need for Yeshua, our need for God to come in and take us out of a very scary, very challenging situation. And it should be our hope and our goal that through the commitment to honesty and integrity, through the commitment to Kiddush Hashem, to all of the values that our dear friend Reb Ozer held so dear, through living a life of Kiddush Hashem, through interacting with the world in a way that draws that respect, that creates this message that we are God's emissaries in this world, that through this behavior we should indeed merit the redemption in every sense of the word, the long-term redemption that we pray for, and also the short-term redemption from the crisis in which we find ourselves. And may his memory continue to be a blessing, continue to be an inspiration and a lesson that we can embody and that we can internalize, and that can continue to guide us through this time and through all of the challenges that we have to endure. Yehi zichro baruch. Thank you very much.